After a stint with the Peace Corps in Congo, Amy Vedder and Bill Weber were hooked on Africa. In 1978, with the help of their friend, the renowned primatologist Richard Wrangham, they managed to organize a research project on mountain gorillas at the legendary Diane Fossey's Karasoki Research Center in Rwanda. They found Fossey difficult to be around. A lot of people did. But everyone was shocked when someone, probably a gorilla poacher, fatally attacked her with a machete in 1985. Vedder and Weber stayed on with the gorillas and founded the Mountain Gorilla Project. 25 years later, they've described their work in the book In the Kingdom of Gorillas. And despite their differences, they still respect Diane Fossey.
She did some very pioneering work. When she began her work with mountain gorillas, she met them on their terms. She didn't give them food, as had been done with chimpanzees. She went out and studied them where they went. And so that work was extraordinary. And it made for a constituency in our country in particular that was very willing to help in gorilla conservation. But Diane was not a conservationist.
She was forced into being a conservationist, I think is what it's fair to say. She came over to study gorillas, I think to get away from the world to a certain degree as well. And what happened was there were pressures being put on the park, there was poaching, gorillas were being killed, and Diane adopted what she saw as the conservationist mode. And that was really the fortress mentality that was common in East Africa at the time. Protect your park, put a wall around it, shoot anybody who comes in. You know, early on, it may have had some limited success in protecting a few small areas, but in fact, half of the park was cleared by the time we got there for agriculture, and nearly half the population had been killed. So her efforts locally were at best not very effective, and you can argue that they were counterproductive in certain ways.
So this was the state when the two of you arrived. You had met with her in the States. You had an approved research project. She had said she would clear the way. But I gather when you arrived in the country, things were not exactly clear. In fact, the story of the day when you first met the conservator, the head of the park.
The director of National Parks.
Yeah, makes it sound as though no groundwork had been done.
Well, we had gone up to the park for a lovely week, and we had met our first gorillas and were settling in when we got a note saying we had to come back to Kigali, the capital city, and meet with the director of the National Park Service in Rwanda, or DPN. And Dismas Nzabimana was a very striking man, and he sat behind his table and said, "What are you doing here?" And we explained what we thought was obvious. We were here to do research, and we were there to help save gorillas and all. And he started saying, "Well, could a Rwandan go to Yellowstone and set themselves up without authorization? Could they build a research station? Could they keep other people from going there?" You know, he threw out all these things, and we weren't quite clear what was going on, but it finally dawned on us that this guy had never heard of us. No authorization had ever been requested or processed. And what we would later learn was that, I mean, Diane held virtually all Rwandans in disdain. She felt no need to collaborate with them. And even asking for authorization to her represented a little loss of her sovereignty over her kingdom up in the mountains.
So what did you do, the two of you, that day? You were faced with the end of your project, this thing that you had worked so hard for.
We apologized. That's all we could do, and said we were terribly sorry, and of course we wouldn't do this again. And we were able to tell him that we weren't coming there to study gorilla behavior and social organization, which virtually everyone else had done, but that our plan was to come and for Amy to study gorilla feeding ecology, habitat use. These were very important issues for park management, and I was coming to do something very strange for those days in the late 70s, which was look at how local people viewed the park, the gorillas, forests, what was in it for them. And they gave us authorization 2 days later, I think, and we were back in the park.
And you came up with the beginnings of the idea of ecotourism.
It was clear that there needed to be some kind of value to people and to the nation in saving the park and saving gorillas. If we could help to encourage the beginning of a tourism program where people would see gorillas, but that would be extremely well controlled, very low impact if we could get controls instituted within the whole system, and yet be able to bring revenue into the park and therefore the country, that there would be a constituency there in country that would understand a reason to save the park. They would see the benefits directly of it.
You know, as you explain it, it sounds perfectly reasonable and obvious, but the response of the conservation community can't have been as automatic in support of it. And a lot of people would say, no. Diane Fossey would say, no, you can't have tourists here. That will destroy the habitat. That will destroy the mountain gorilla.
Well, Diane did say that. The conservation community in those days was much smaller. And actually, most of them seemed to have written off the gorillas.
And in fact, there was also an alternative plan at the time being hatched at the governmental level and with expert advisors from Europe to actually excise and cut down another one-third of the national park and convert it into cattle ranches.
So in a way, you got there just in time with a proposal to the government. Now, I mean, was it an easy sell? Did the government say, oh, what a brilliant idea?
No, in fact, you know, and it shows how serendipity plays into all of this. You know, I found out because I was going around talking with people about something completely different, and I met up with a Swiss forester. And as we were talking about something else, he said, mais vous ne savez pas, you don't know. And I said, know what? And he said, you know, they've agreed to cut one-third of the park. And so we went up and told Diane. When I told her about this plan to cut the park, she really just seemed drawn out, depressed, and, oh.
She didn't have an answer.
Yeah, she didn't know what to do. Yeah. And she didn't have contacts in the government or any support at that point.
Yeah, she could control events in the park, but she was so cut off from everybody outside, she couldn't.
So who did you
events.
Go to then?
Well, we went to everyone we could. First, I went to confirm what was happening with the Ministry of Agriculture, and I was told that, well, of course we're doing a cattle project. This is a poor country, monsieur, and don't you know that? And your gorillas are a silly little affair. That wasn't very productive. So this guy sent me down to the Rwandan. This is a European. He sent me to the Rwandan director of élevage, cattle production, I guess. And he pulled out a little sheet and told me all the facts and figures and how they were going to make, I forget, I think $70,000 a year from this project, of which he was very proud. Mm-hmm. I was going to generate a certain number of jobs, et cetera. And I thanked him very much. And that's when we dropped all of our research. We dropped any other plans and really focus on stopping this. And that's when we had been thinking about tourism, but we hadn't decided. And then we decided to go full bore for a tourism program, went to the Park Service and said, look, you can make much more money off of gorillas than they are going to make off of cattle, and you have to make that case. And I remember the director of tourism saying, well, you like to go out and do that, but are there really other people who like to go crawl around the park?
Steep
like
slopes, cold, wet, sure. Muddy. Really, people won't want to come, is
nettles.
What he said.
And you made the case that there were a lot of people around the world who would love to pay a lot of money to come.
We weren't sure, but we really thought that. I mean, it was just a magical place. And we said, yeah, there are thousands of them. You know, a lot of crazy white people. Abazungu Fu. And he started laughing. He goes, ah, the milliers des Abazungu Fu. And we said, yeah. And that really was where the thing started.
This is a success story in many ways so far. You did turn around a government attitude toward the habitat of the mountain gorilla. Unfortunately, the next part of the story, at least in my mind, is that Rwanda exploded.
Yeah, if you look, we started the Mountain Gorilla Project in the late 1970s. The 80s were really a golden age for that project. The anti-poaching worked incredibly well. There was one gorilla killed throughout the 80s after so many before that. The tourism program brought in $1 million in direct revenue from 6,000 or 7,000 tourists that peaked in 1989. Those people spent another $4 or 5 million a year, and the country that became the third source of foreign revenue in the country. Education was starting to have some impact. It really was incredibly successful, and the bottom line, the gorilla numbers went up to 320 by 1989.
One of the very gratifying aspects of all of that for us, though, too, is that we had helped to launch this in the late 70s, early 80s, but other people had carried it on. And in fact, it was virtually all of this was in Rwandan hands, very professional, capable Rwandan hands.
But then you get to the end of the 80s, and there are already signs, a government that had been a benign dictatorship, a relatively moderate government through the late 70s, early 80s, by the late 80s was becoming increasingly corrupt, self-interested, fratricidal in some ways. And then come 1990, you had Tutsi refugees, really the sons of Tutsi refugees from the end of the independence period around 1960, had been in exile in Uganda. They saw the political structure falling apart in Rwanda, and they thought, hey, maybe this is the time we can come back and reclaim our seat at the table, thinking in the beginning about some kind of power-sharing arrangement. That launched a alternating low to medium-scale civil war over 3 years.
As researchers, you're, of course, interested in the political structure of the country. It makes all the difference in whether the ecotourism business is going to continue. But was there a day-to-day effect on the research station?
Well, at Karasoke, the research station, during the midst of those 3 to 4 years of civil war, people were evacuated several times over. The northern part of the country was really part of the main battlefield during the 4 years of civil war. And so it was right in and around that area that most of the fighting took place. During that period of time, you actually had combatants on both sides of that war declaring to the international press they wouldn't harm the park or the guerrillas in the midst of war.
Was that original commitment to leaving them alone respected?
Well, at that point in time, the northern part of the country was in the hands of Tutsis. And so as the genocide began to take place in 94, the massive killings were further south. And so there was this stroke of history that meant that the north at that point, which had been the center of turmoil, was in fact somewhat buffered from the very worst of the events.
So what is the future of a plan like yours, the ecotourism that worked so well in the 80s and was a disaster in the 90s. Is there a future for it now in a place like Rwanda with its history?
Very much so, and we're beginning to see that future played out right now. This year, for the first time, people have felt it is secure enough, and staff have been back and been able to reestablish the system of tourism. And this summer really was the first influx of tourists coming from across the world back to Rwanda to see guerrillas. During 10 years of turmoil, the government's maintained a commitment to that park without having the revenue come in for tourism. Now it's coming in. That will help to build a future, and it's happening.
Amy Vetter and Bill Weber are the authors of In the Kingdom of Gorillas, Fragile Species in a Dangerous Land.